please put your hands together, give a very warm welcome to Greg Johnson.
I want to thank Jez Turner for making this possible, organizing this. I know how difficult it is to find venues and organize things and get people in, and it's a tremendous amount of work. He deserves a lot of respect. I want to thank Michael Woodbridge for being a host and chauffeur and tour guide and sounding board. Everything I'm going to say, he's already heard at least twice now as I've been rehearsing it with him as we were driving around the hills of Wales. This is the first time I've been in England. My ancestors came to what is now the United States from England in the 17th century, and this is my first time here. And I was surprised that when I got here, it didn't feel like I was going abroad, but that I was coming home. That's a good thing, and it's a bad thing. It's a good thing in the sense that there's a lot of continuity in the United States from England. And it's a bad thing because there's a lot of American crap culture circulating around here, and I was really kind of surprised at the amount of that. So for good or ill, I feel like I have returned home after a very long absence. I'm going to talk today about a topic that's somewhat esoteric. And the reason I chose this sort of topic is I was fond of Jonathan Bowden, and I understood that he could get people together to listen to a lecture on Heidegger or Robinson Jeffers, things like that. And I thought, well, I'd like to give a lecture on a little-known thinker who I think is very important for our cause, our interests. His name is Giovanni Battista Vico. He was an Italian philosopher, and it's a sort of indication of how little went on in the world of Italian philosophy between the Renaissance and the 20th century that most people think Vico was a Renaissance figure. But actually, he was born in 1668, died in 1744. Most of his writings were published in the early 18th century. He's a figure from the Enlightenment. And he's also the first and most fundamental critic of the Enlightenment. And I think that since we here are interested in a critical appropriation of the Enlightenment, it behooves us to look at the first counter-Enlightenment thinker, and that was Vico. And he was a counter-Enlightenment thinker before the Enlightenment was even really up and running. He had already figured out the bugs and written it all down. And he has something to offer us today. So I'm trying to give as naive an introduction to Vico as possible. I'm going to leave time for questions at the end. I've been asking myself for years, say, why so few people on the New Right talk about Vico. And then it occurred to me that I hadn't given them an introduction yet. So I decided to take it upon myself to introduce the New Right to Gian Battista Vico. Vico is sometimes mentioned in footnotes. He gets about this much space in Potted Histories of Western Philosophy as the inventor of the philosophy of history or the philosophy of culture. And his goal was to create a universal science of history and culture, which he called the New Science. And the New Science is an extension of the Enlightenment. It's an extension of modernity. It's an extension of the use of reason to understand society, to understand human nature. Vico belongs to the Enlightenment in the sense that he uses critical reason, and he's extending it from the natural sciences, where it was flourishing with Newton and Galileo and so forth, and he's extending it into the human region. And yet, once he extended natural science into the realm of the human, he arrived at policy conclusions that were diametrically opposed to the liberal, progressive, Enlightenment policies of the rest of the Enlightenment movement. And so he is the first counter-Enlightenment thinker, and yet he is a thinker of the Enlightenment. Vico makes it possible to give a rational defense of man's basic irrationality. He gives a non-religious defense of religion. He gives a non-traditional defense of traditions, an unconventional defense of convention. He's a non-historical defender of historical life and particularity and identity. Vico argued that there are three fundamental institutions of society: religion, family, and what he called burial, the burial of the dead. But by burial, he didn't just mean the burial of the dead, but he meant the sacralization of a particular piece of ground, and therefore settled existence, localism, as opposed to being nomadic. And he also argued for a cyclical theory of history. Now, universally, the left is about progress. The Enlightenment was about progress. The Enlightenment is progress from darkness, superstition, tradition, religion, and so forth, to reason. There's an onward and upward trajectory, a narrative of forward motion. And the left draws upon this pre-existing historical narrative to suggest the next step. It's never enough. We can always progress more. We can always intensify the basic premises of modernity, the basic premises of egalitarianism more. On the right, we tend to be skeptical of progress, and many of us are enamored of the idea of the cyclical nature of history. Now, both the cyclical idea of history and the progressive idea of history have roots in religion and myth. But in the 18th and 19th centuries, the thinkers of the Enlightenment and thinkers like Marx tried to give a rational, scientific foundation for the idea of progress. They were not particularly successful, but they made strong efforts and they convinced a lot of people that indeed progress is sort of baked into what's going on and that things will continue to progress in the direction of liberalism, basically. Hegel, and based on Hegel, Kozhev and other 20th century interpreters of Hegel like Francis Fukuyama argued that when communism collapsed, history had ended with the triumph of liberal democracy. These ideas are very powerful to this day, and they try to give some kind of foundation in history and human nature for these beliefs. Whereas we on the new right, broadly speaking, we love to talk about the cycles of time. Even Mark was talking about the Kali Yuga today. That was a new one to me. You hear Kali Yuga, and practically 70% of the time you're dealing with somebody who's plugged into the new right. We're the only ones who talk about it today. But when you actually look at how we use this terminology, and I use it all the time, I find myths and images to be very powerful ways of organizing ideas and communicating them. But if you actually go into the details of what the traditionalists say about the Golden Age and the decline and so forth, they say a lot of things that are patently untrue. The image of the Golden Age that you get from traditional Hinduism or from Hellenists is that it was a time of what Vico described as abstruse and recondite wisdom. What does it mean? He meant that it's a time when everyone's a philosopher, when people are highly evolved mentally and in contact intuitively with objective truths of nature. And Vico said, well, that's patently untrue. Man begins rude and crude and barbarous and dominated by his senses and his imagination. It's only very much later in history that we arrive at abstract and recondite ideas, which are then projected backward on the Golden Age. And Vico is dealing with a kind of traditionalism. That's one of his enemies in the New Science. The other position that Vico is criticizing is the Epicureans, and specifically the Epicurean idea of early man. The Epicureans believed that early man was rude and crude and primitive and barbarous. And their idea of early man and of the evolution of man is actually extremely consistent with another faction within the New Right, which are the people who are interested in biological evolution, the people who are interested in sociobiology, ethology, evolutionary psychology, and so forth, the materialist crowd. The Epicureans are the original evolutionary materialists. And Vico is also criticizing the Epicureans as well. And what he does is he criticizes both the traditionalists of his time, but he maintains their cyclical view of history, their focus on religion, their focus on the humanities, if you will, their social conservatism, and their general interest in the liberal arts side. And he criticizes the materialists of his time, the Epicureans, but he maintains their essentially naturalistic hard science approach to understanding man. And so he tries to come up with a synthesis of a traditionalistic cyclical view of history and social conservatism and a critique of the Enlightenment that is also consistent with what is known about man's real evolution and our prehistory and our history. And so what Vico did in the 18th century is offer a synthesis that the new right today dearly needs. Because I know lots of people within the space of a single conversation, I include myself in this, will move from talking about what Evola says about the Golden Age and the decline and the cyclical nature of history and regression of the castes and all that, to what Philippe Rushton had to say about genetic similarity theory. And someday somebody is going to call me on it and say, well, wait a second here. These two worldviews are completely inconsistent. Evola believed that man in the Golden Age was a highly advanced being who devolved. And the whole evolutionary approach believes just the opposite. How do you reconcile these two things? A lot of us carry around unreconciled ideas, and Vico is important for the new right because he offers a way of reconciling the two. So let me go into a little bit of detail about how he does that. The traditionalists in Vico's time were Plato and the Neoplatonists, basically, who, when they look back at Homer and Hesiod and other early Greek writers, projected this idea of the Golden Age as an age of abstract wisdom, where man was intuitively in touch with deep truths. And then what happened is after the Golden Age, man declines. He declines into a world where opinion rather than truth reigns, where nature is no longer a guide, but rather conventions spring up, customs, culture. Culture consists of conventions. Nature is the same wherever you go, but conventions change. Nature is pretty much the same in Wales as it is just across the border, but you know, it's interesting to hear Welsh being spoken. I've never heard it spoken before. Languages are conventions, and people who are naturally very similar genetically, who live in similar landscapes, similar environments, even have similar institutions, can have radically different conventions, like different languages. Nature is always the same across the board. Conventions change from time to time and place to place. And the Platonists looked upon the decline from the Golden Age into the later ages as a decline from the reign of truth, the age of truth is what the Hindus call the Golden Age, to living at greater and greater remove from the truth, living in terms of conventions and customs and illusions. It's entering what Plato called the cave, where we're just looking at opinions rather than the truth. And so the Platonists see history as a fall, as a decline. It's a horrible, ghastly mistake that needs to be erased. It's something that we need to be redeemed from. Now, the Epicureans, the early materialists, also looked upon the beginning of history as something of a fall because they had a very different view of man. They believed that man was a simple creature without intellect who was simply driven by his material desires, pleasure and pain. Now, pleasure and pain, if you just limit yourself to the natural desires that you have, it's pretty easy to satisfy those things. You need food and shelter and a little bit of companionship. But what happens when you leave the state of nature and enter into society is we get artificial desires. We are taught to desire things that we don't really need. And as Eric Hoffer said, you can never get enough of what you don't really need. Right? And so the emergence into history is the emergence of the rat race, basically, where people are running themselves ragged to satisfy desires that are entirely artificial. And that is a source of misery. And so these early materialists, these Epicureans, looked upon the beginning of history as a fall, again, as a source of alienation and suffering. And the common denominator between both the traditionalists of Vico's time and the materialists is they could not accept historical life as good. They both regarded it as a fall, either the fall of the philosopher into the realm of opinion or the fall of the happy brute into the realm of convention and the rat race. They couldn't come up with a defense of what we're interested in, which is really defending the plurality of different historical communities, our different cultures, our different ways of life. They couldn't defend any identity other than a natural identity, either the natural identity of the man who is totally determined by objective truth, which is true for everyone, or the loping, primal, ape-like creature who is totally determined by his natural needs, which again are the same. Natural man, whether he's conceived of as an ape or as a kind of semi-divine being, doesn't need and can't even understand the necessity of having four different languages or five or millions of languages. None of that makes sense. Nature is one. Culture is many. Culture, therefore, by this account, is a mistake. And this is why Epicureanism had radical implications, radical political implications. Back to nature is basically what it says. Back to nature. Our happiness lies in nature. If we go back to nature, we have to slough off culture. We have to slough off differences. We have to slough off our identities. Now, within the New Right, we don't have any sort of modern Epicureans who are talking like that. But there is a tendency amongst evolutionary psychologists and sociobiologists to look upon culture as something mysterious and suspicious. And what they generally try to do is they try and argue, for instance, Jeffrey Miller has a book called Spent, which is about consumerism. And it's about luxury. It's about the stuff that we don't really need. And he tries to come up with a biological explanation for it. And he says that buying things you don't really need is a form of signaling fitness to potential mates. So he's trying to reduce that element of culture into basic biological needs for reproduction. Why? Because there's just a discomfort with the realm of culture as such. And if you can't reduce it down to nature, you almost want to ignore it or get rid of it. Vico is a conservative, and that means what he's trying to do is he's trying to come up with a defense of historical life, a defense of culture, a defense of particular identities. And so what he says is what's golden about the Golden Age, for Vico, is not wisdom in the abstract sense. There is something golden about it. There's something very, very important that we have at the earliest phase of history, and that is vitality. Early man was not smart or cultured, but he was vital. He was a vital barbarian. And he was ruled by his senses and his passions, but he also had a powerful imagination. And the interaction of our common nature, which Vico stressed, all human beings have the same basic nature. And they also face the same necessities of life. And he said these crude beings with their powerful imaginations and passions, when they encounter the necessities of life, will spontaneously generate culture. And that culture is not something that is a fall that has to be erased in some way. Because what happens is the development of civilization for Vico is a process whereby we actualize ourselves. It's a process of self-actualization for humanity, not just self-alienation. The animal man is alienated. We can't pee wherever we please anymore, right? That's inconvenient. We have all kinds of rules for governing the satisfaction of our bodily needs. That puts limits on us as an animal. But Vico's arguing that those limitations are more than made up for the fact that man has a social nature and an intellectual nature, and that the process of developing civilization is a process of actualizing our social nature and our intellectual nature. And so what he does is he calls this a theodicy, actually. He said he was giving a rational, civil theology of divine providence. Now, that's a big mouthful. But what's he saying? He's saying that there's a providential order to history. And he's very careful to say that he's not talking about providence in the biblical sense. He's not talking about sacred history. He's not talking about the Bible. Because, of course, that's a linear view of history, and he's offering a cyclical one. And there was this thing going on in Naples, this institution that had been set up by the Spanish, actually, called the Inquisition, the Holy Inquisition. And they looked askance at people who were offering radically different alternative viewpoints to what the church taught. So Vico was very careful. He said, I'm only talking about the Gentile nations here. Right? I'm not talking about sacred history. I'm just talking about the history of the Gentiles. But he said, within the history of the nations, the Gentiles, there is a kind of providence at work. It's not the providence of the biblical God, but it's a process of self-actualization of man, and that justifies history. We don't have to look upon culture as something that merely does violence to our nature. It's something that perfects our nature as well. It does violence to the animal nature. It perfects the distinctly human aspects of our nature. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about Vico's primal institutions and how they come about, and his analysis, his scientific analysis, if you will, of what underlies the four ages, the cyclical view of history, the cycle of decline and rebirth that he believes that all civilizations go through. Because, again, it's a desirable thing for us to stop using this cyclical view of history as merely a myth or an image, but actually find a way of talking about it that's consistent with what we know about human evolution, human prehistory, human history. I should say that Oswald Spengler, does make an attempt to give an account of a cyclical view of history that's not just mythical in the traditionalist sense. Spengler believes that man starts out primitive and rude, right? There are problems with Spengler's view, but Spengler is basically very consistent with Vico. He was not, as I can tell, influenced by Vico. And this is one of the most interesting things about Vico. Vico had almost no influence on anybody. And you look at this and you think, oh, he came up with the Encounter Enlightenment 50 years before anybody else, but nobody read him. He died in 1744. His works were unread for almost 100 years. There are only two thinkers of real first-class merit who could be described as fundamentally influenced by Vico. One is George Sorel, the syndicalist, who has a lot to say to us. And the other is James Joyce. In fact, one time I taught a course on Vico's New Science, and I began by passing out the first page of Finnegan's Wake. And so I passed it out, and everyone was looking at it, and wondering what the hell, you know. And so I read the first page of Finnegan's Wake. I tried not to read it with an Irish accent, because I would have sounded like a schizophrenic leprechaun. There's a recording of Joyce reading it, and it does sound like a schizophrenic leprechaun. And they were all shaking their heads, and they thought, he's gone mad. What's he trying to do? And I said, okay, I'm not going to comment on this. Just tuck it in the back of the book, and at the end of this class, we're going to read this page again. And so at the end of the course, we pulled out the first page of Finnegan's Wake, and we started reading through it, and as we got into the first sentence, people said, oh, that's Vico! I see it now! In the first sentence, Joyce talks about the commodious vicus of recirculation. And it's like, ah, Vico. Vicus means path. Vico comes from the term for path. Vico's New Science is the most influential single text on Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. And a basic understanding of Vico turns Finnegan's Wake from schizophrenic leprechaun gibberish to one of the great sort of epic poems of the 20th century, and it's a poem about everything, because Vico was really writing about everything. Because he's writing about the whole of human history, but the whole of human history touches on everything else, too. So I'll commend this to you as an aid for reading Joyce, should you ever be tempted to do that as well. Vico talked about four ages, just like Hesiod does, just like the Hindus do. Vico said there's an age of gods, the first age, an age of heroes, and an age of men. And then the fourth age doesn't have a name, but it's an age of disillusion, where things fall apart. The Hindus talk about the first age as the age of truth, the Satya Yuga, and then they have the two other yugas, which are just named the third and second age, basically Treta and Dvapara Yuga. And then the last age is the Kali Yuga, the dark age, which is the age of disintegration. With Hesiod, you have the age of gold, the age of silver, the age of bronze, and the age of iron. In Finnegan's Wake, he names the four ages egg burst, egg blend, egg burial, and hatches hatch can. And the egg burst refers to a myth that I'm going to now relate to you. Because Vico didn't just talk about myth, he used myth to illustrate things. And basically this is Vico's myth about how the primal institutions arise. He said, imagine the world after the flood, because he had to square everything with the Bible, right? Imagine the world after the flood. The sons of Ham and Japheth have wandered off to found the Gentile nations, and they have grown rude and crude and unlettered. They've lost language, they've lost culture, they've become solitary, right? Asocial, they've become cyclopean-type people. He actually believed they grew to giant size. Okay. So giants wandered the forests of the earth after the flood. And these giants, they would fornicate occasionally if they would bump into a giantess, but they didn't form any families, they didn't have language, they didn't have conventions of any sort, but they had a powerful imagination. And Vico says, well, imagine what happened after the flood. As the earth dried out, the atmosphere would start getting humid as the mud dries out. And he said, there must have been such storms, storms all over the world. And when the thunder rumbled and the lightning flashed, the giants, who were very frightened beings and very imaginative beings, called out Jove. Okay? They gave a name to the thunder, and they called it Jove. And he said that this is an illustration of how primitive beings might have formed language and gods at the same time. And later writers on this very issue, Ernst Cassirer, who's a 20th century German Jewish philosopher of culture, has a book on language and myth. And he says language and myth start with the same thing. They start with names. Names are given to things by primitive men as a way of trying to master something that frightens them. The primal motive behind the creation of religion is coping with things that cause us fear. And then the Epicureans later said, and of course we don't want to be ruled by fear, so we have to get rid of religion, right? This is part of the implicitly revolutionary aspect of this materialism, right? If religion is caused by fear, then as we grow up as human beings and become modern, we want to get rid of all that. We don't want to be ruled by fear anymore. Vico then said, once the giants conceived that the sky was a god, well, the sky is always above us. It's always watching us. And so they imagined that the sky was always watching us, and that made them self-conscious. So instead of just fornicating with random giantesses that they would encounter in the woods, they would drag them off to caves and lairs where they could do their business undercover, away from the sky. And that this was the base, the beginning of the family. So the family arrived because the giants felt shame. And then, because the caves were in one place, and they weren't just wandering around, when they fell dead, you don't just leave your dead laying around. You do something with them. And so he believed that the inhumation of the dead was one of the ways that man invested something in the landscape around him, that the landscape and property and our relations to it were originally sacred relations, that property is just something you buy and sell was a much later thing. And so, through the burial of the dead, man became invested in place. There was a sacred bond between man and place. These are the origins of the primal institutions of society. This an account of their origins sits radically at variance with what the Enlightenment says, because in the Enlightenment we have this idea of the social contract, right? people think, well, customs are conventions. How do you create conventions? Well, you sit down and you agree on things. There's a New Yorker cartoon called The Origin of Language, and it illustrates the absurdity of the Enlightenment's idea of how conventions come about. It's called The Origin of Language. There's a caveman sitting sullen on the floor of the cave, and the cave woman is at the door of the cave with her hands on her hips, looking very stern at him, and she says, "We need to talk." Right. That's how language came about. We needed to talk, so we talked. And it's pointing out, of course, that that's not how language came about, because she already had to have language to say we need to talk, right? So that's the joke. When you look at sort of social contract accounts of the origins of society, they are very naive because they presuppose that you have enough language and civility, you recognize that you're members of a group, you trust one another enough to make agreements. All of these things pre-exist any kind of artificial compact that comes into existence, right? And therefore the idea that you get in, say, the American Declaration of Independence, that man is has the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. That's a preposterous notion. Governments never were instituted like that. Vico's account of it is that governments grew from family relationships and extended tribes, that the patriarchal family evolved into the government, and that these things did not happen through conscious reasoning. These were very crude people. Language developed slowly over time. The ability to reflect critically came about very late. Hell, it doesn't come about at all in most people, as you well know, right? Most people are passive followers, even really smart people. My family's full of extremely smart people, and they're almost all extremely conventional. So the idea that critical reason is at the root of society is preposterous. And so what Vico says is that the implications of this are obvious. The Enlightenment attitude that institutions that are not founded based on reason and that cannot give a rational account of their utility should be done away with. It is basically a kind of nihilism that will dissolve society. Okay? And so the fourth age for Vico is really the age where the barbarism of sense, as he calls it, the early barbarism of the first age, is replaced by a new barbarism, and he calls that the barbarism of reflection. The barbarism of reflection thinks that it's making things better, but it can't make things better. It ultimately dissolves the bonds of sociality, and therefore society returns to chaos. And I want to read a couple of passages here. This is from the end of his book, The New Science. The Age of Gods is the first age when religion, family, and settled life begin. The Age of Heroes is the second age where you have the rise of aristocratic societies. It's the Homeric Age. The Age of Men is the age of popular government, of democracy. And the fourth age, Hatch as Hatch Can, the Kali Yuga, the disillusion, comes about when within these democratic societies, skepticism and materialism and the barbarism of reflection takes over and dissolves the constituent bonds of society. Okay, so let me give you a taste of Vico, because one of the reasons I think we should read Vico is not just for the light that he shines on certain things, but also for the pleasure of reading him, because he was a professor of eloquence. And even though sometimes his ideas are kind of thorny and sometimes his examples are frustrating because we don't know nearly as much today about Roman history as he was taking for granted, for instance. If you were writing today, he'd be using examples from Star Trek, I guess. And it would be as intelligible. This is from the conclusion of The New Science. As the popular states, democracies, became corrupt, so also did philosophies. They descended to skepticism. Learned fools fell to calumniating the truth. Thence alone rose a false eloquence, ready to uphold either of the opposed sides of a case indifferently. Sounds familiar so far, right? Thus it came about that, by abuse of eloquence, like that of the tribunes of the plebs of Rome, when the citizens were no longer content with making wealth the basis of rank, period goes off into Roman history. I'm going to skip forward. Thus they caused the commonwealths to fall from the perfect liberty into the perfect tyranny of anarchy, or the unchecked liberty of the free peoples. He's talking about how demagogues whip up democracies and install themselves as tyrants. So the Fourth Age really is the age of the tyrant. And then he says, to this great disease of cities, Providence applies one of three great remedies in the following order of human civil institutions. First, it ordains that there be found among these peoples a man like Augustus, to arise and establish himself as a monarch, and by force of arms take in hand all the institutions and all the laws, which, though sprung from liberty, no longer avail to regulate and hold it within bounds. On the other hand, Providence ordains that the very form of the monarchic state shall confine the will of the monarchs, in spite of their unlimited sovereignty, within the natural order of keeping the peoples content and satisfied with both their religion and their natural liberty. So this is what Spengler calls Caesarism. And that's like the best outcome. The next best outcome is this. Then if Providence does not find such a remedy within, it seeks it outside. And since people so far corrupted have already become naturally slaves of their unrestrained passions of luxury, effeminacy, avarice, envy, pride, and vanity, and in pursuit of the pleasures of their dissolute life are falling back into all the vices characteristic of the most abject slaves, having become liars, tricksters, thieves, cowards, and pretenders, Providence decrees that they become slaves by the natural law of the gentes, which spring from the nature of nations, and that they become subject to better nations, which, having conquered them by arms, preserve them as subject provinces. Herein the two great lights of natural order shine forth, and this is very interesting. First, that he who cannot govern himself must let himself be governed by another who can, and second, the world is always governed by those who are naturally fittest. This is a long time before Darwin was talking, or social Darwinism came along, but this is in Vico. But if you can't find that second best solution, then you're doomed. Society goes to perdition. And this is his description of perdition. But if the peoples are rotting in that ultimate civil disease and cannot agree on a monarch from within and are not conquered and preserved by better nations from without, then Providence for their extreme ill has its extreme remedy at hand. For such peoples, like so many beasts, have fallen into the custom of each man thinking only of his own private interests and have reached the extreme of delicacy, or better, of pride, in which, like wild animals, they bristle and lash out at the slightest displeasure. Sounds like the internet to me. Thus, no matter how great the throng and press of their bodies, they live like wild beasts in a deep solitude of spirit and will, scarcely any two being able to agree, since each follows his own pleasure or caprice. It sounds like the New York subway to me, where there's this great press of people who are sunk into the solitude of individualism. There's nothing that holds them together except the press of their bodies and the tube that they're going through. By reason of all this, Providence decrees that through obstinate factions and desperate civil wars, they shall turn their cities into forests, and the forests into dens and lairs of men. In this way, through long centuries of barbarism, rust will consume the misbegotten subtleties of malicious wits that have turned them into beasts, made more inhuman by the barbarism of reflection than the first men had been made by the barbarism of sense. For the latter displayed a generous savagery, against which one could defend oneself or take flight or be on one's guard, but the former, with a base savagery, under soft words and embraces, plots against the life and fortunes of friends and intimates. Hence peoples who have reached this point of premeditated malice, when they receive this last remedy of Providence, are thereby stunned and brutalized, are sensible no longer of comforts, delicacies, pleasures, and pomp, but only of the sheer necessities of life. And again, for Vico, we all have a common nature. He calls this our common mental dictionary. He's a universalist in that sense. He believes that there's a single human nature. He's not a cultural relativist. Underlying culture is a universal human nature, which, under the impress of natural necessity, again, will give rise to the the birth of culture again. And so we will return to the barbarism of sense, but we won't tarry there long because the self-actualization of man requires that history begin over again. So, and this is an account of a cyclical view of history that seeks to ground itself in an understanding of human faculties, right? He has a discussion of human vitality, discussion of how imagination gives rise to institutions, and then how reflection comes along later in history and alienates us from institutions. And that once reflection alienates us from participation and identity, then we become deracinated. We become selfish and individualistic, and people like that cannot maintain a civilization. So this is an account based on nature that gives some understanding for how a cyclical view of history that supports our kinds of political conclusions, our kinds of analyses of what's right and wrong in the world, can be made. And it's important because it takes an account of man that's consistent with natural science, and yet can combine it with an account of history that leads us to conclusions that people on the new right would like to support. So that's my brief for Vico. There was a claim that was made in the 60s, at the height of the 68 generation, the height of the New Left, about Evola. Somebody said, Evola, he's our Marcuse, only better. And so I give you Giambattista Vico, our Marx, only better.
We do have some questions, I hope.
Alright, you first.
Was he influenced by Aristotle in politics? Because his politics was cyclical. For you have monarchy, and then you have oligarchy, then you have democracy, then you have chaos, and then back to monarchy.
Even though he's criticizing a kind of Platonism, he claimed that Plato was one of his great influences. And Plato, in books 8 and 9 of the Republic, has an account of the cycles of regimes like that. And so, yeah, he's very similar in that. He believed, Plato talks about how aristocratic society gives way to oligarchic society, that gives way to democracy, that gives way to tyranny. And that's basically a scheme that Vico endorses. Yeah. So he's very influenced by Plato, even though he denies the idea that man in the Golden Age is somehow a Platonic philosopher king. Any other questions? Yes.
Is there any possibility that Hegel, who thought of a synthesis in history, could give not either cyclical or one that was heading in a direction, but come out with something completely new, a bit of something in the past, a bit of something that synthesizes together into something that we don't recognize?
Well, I think that everybody who argues for a cyclical view of history doesn't literally argue that everything happens the same. What they do argue is that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And so each cycle has the same underlying structure, the same patterns emerge over and over again, but no, it's not the same names, it's not the same exact story in every jot and tittle, but it is the same pattern. And so, yeah, there's a recognition that novelty takes place, but novelty is constrained within these great macro patterns of the cycles.
Talking about Vico saying, you can go back to nature,
if you didn't hear, she's basically saying that in England and certainly in the United States, there is a big back-to-nature movement. Now, I don't think that Vico would have any problem with the back-to-nature kind of stuff in that sense, but he is criticizing the idea that civilization as such does violence to human nature. Therefore, if we could, we should chuck it all, right, and be happy bonobos, eating bananas and polymorphously perverse and all that kind of stuff. He's not saying that that's a good idea. But at the same time, I think, of course, he was a man who lived in Naples in the 18th century, I think he would have been horrified by the artificial civilization that we have today. But at the same time, he wouldn't say that artifice as such is a bad thing, because artifice is an expression of, an actualization of, another part of our nature. And so I think that all the hobbit virtues have a place in Vico's idea of how the world should be. He's certainly not endorsing a radical back-to-nature kind of idea. I don't even know if any radical environmentalists, maybe the people who want total human extinction or something, would endorse something like that. But most of them, you know, still have their iPhones and fly around and so forth. Any other questions? You.
I understand Vico's theory is sort of kind of like Spain was this kind of city of nature and stuff. But also, doesn't it, using those theories, we understand that, you know, we can use these as writers, if you like, sort of against Hegel and Marx and some of the you know, linear views of history we might see in Christianity and so on, which could fuel modern liberalism, which gives it that end point. However, taking on Vico's theories or Spengler's or any of the cyclical theories, doesn't it also fill you with a deep pessimism that it's almost telling us that it's too late and thus we must give up? Because if you, or as we kind of fight, you know, save Europe, save our civilization, isn't that even kind of contradicting Vico, because Vico already believes that it's a cycle, it's too late, so you're kind of contradicting.
Well, yeah, that's a good point, it's a good question. Just one thing about Vico and Spengler first. Spengler is a kind of cultural relativist, and Vico simply flatly denies cultural relativism. Spengler says there's Greek mathematics and other kinds of mathematics. Vico would say, no, there's math. Things are not that marked by cultural differentiation. I don't think that Vico is a pessimist in this sense. I guess we're all pessimists if we admit the fact that we're all going to die, right? Given enough time, our survival chances are zero, right? Is that pessimism? Do you really mope around a lot about that? I mean, I don't. I think about it occasionally, and then I just think I've got to thrust this bad thought out of my mind and do something positive with the time that I've got, right? So, but in terms of the struggle, if you will, I think it's a profoundly encouraging idea for me, because we know that we're living in the dregs of the dark age. It's really, really bad. And it's good to have this attitude, to get rid of the conservative attitude, that if we could only restore the Constitution, if only we could get back to the perfect form of government, say, England in the 19th century, which is pretty close to what I would consider the perfect form of government. If only we could get back to that, everything would be fine. Well, it's too late for that, right? It's too late for all of that. And it's just a waste of energy to focus backwards so we can focus forwards. And you know, there are things that one can do to prepare. René Guénon, in The Crisis of the Modern World, said that there's nothing you can do to stop the end of this world, which is optimism. I'm happy to hear that. I want this world to end. I heartily want it to end within my lifetime. There's nothing we can do to stop it. There's very little we could probably do to hurry it along, although that bears some pondering, given how fragile this system is. But there are things that we can do to shorten the chaos that will follow, and there are things that we can do to preserve things of genuine value that we want to survive into the next age. The crash of pagan antiquity is one of the great tragedies. It's heartbreaking. I can't contemplate it very long. You know, the plays of Sophocles are recognized as some of the great literature that we have. We have about 1 out of 5 plays that Sophocles wrote. All the rest have been lost. And we're lucky to have anything by Sophocles at all. There are many, many playwrights that we only know their names. The crash of pagan culture is one of the great tragedies of history. At the end of his book, After Virtue, Alistair MacIntyre says, we have to start thinking like the Benedictines. The barbarians aren't outside. They've been ruling over us for a long time. And we have to start finding ways of preserving things through the end that will be useful at the beginning of the next cycle. I find that all very encouraging, actually. And so I don't think it depresses us. And here's another consideration. There's this notion of duty that Mark mentioned. The Hindus have this idea that you have your dharma, you've got your duty. You've got the same duty no matter what age you live in. it's the duty of the warrior to fight for what's righteous. And if the warrior has the bad luck of living in the dregs of the Dark Age, he still has the duty to fight for what's right, and it doesn't matter if he can be successful or not. Because duty is duty regardless of outcome. And I think that that's how we should look at it. The kind of people who think, well, I mean, if we can't win, we shouldn't try, they're ignoble. Maybe they're called to be merchants or something. But I think we're all called to be warriors, right? We're all called to fight this. And the consequences at that point don't matter. And as it turns out, oddly enough, though, and this is sort of how providence works, or destiny works, sometimes when you give up on the consequences, and Bhagavad Gita talks about this, it's like, don't worry about the consequences, do your duty to your utmost, let the gods sort out the consequences. It's too big for you to calculate anyway. I've often found that in my life, I've had the greatest success after I gave up worrying about the consequences. Yes. Yeah. So, in a kind of sly way, maybe more practical to not worry too much about the outcome. Question.
Well, yeah. Well, I was just going to say that the whole point of the cyclical view is also that. There is no point. There is no end.
Yeah.
You have to love the process.
Right.
Love the fight.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And that's its own course.
Right. And we're not going to win forever. Right.
No.
You know, we'll win and things will get better, and then we'll go through the same process that we've seen before. The only ultimate defeat that we could suffer is if we cease to exist as a distinct biological group. Extinction is forever, and we have to be very concerned about that, but that's the only ultimate loss. The rest of the battles for culture and civilization and so forth, we're going to win and lose and win and lose, because that's in our nature. Again, Vico, he's our Marx, he gives us a scientific foundation for our kind of theory of history, and he's better. So thank you very much.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.